just is not a good time to be personally standing up and smiling because you get a big bonus when you've got a tight budget.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents rescinds President Pat Gamble's retention bonus. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, new research suggests an aging population may have contributed to Pacific walruses' decline.
Reproduction and calf survival were probably quite low at that point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents late yesterday voted to rescind President Pat Gamble's $320,000 retention bonus by a 9-1 vote. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The board reviewed the decision to award the bonus at the request of University of Alaska President Pat Gamble. Pat Jacobson is the chair of the Board of Regents.
I think a number of us felt that a deal is a deal, and it was a commitment we had made. And so we did it with some reluctance. At the same time, again, this gentleman, this very capable gentleman who has done such a good job for the university, felt it was the thing that we needed to do in order to move forward positively. And so we accepted it.
The board originally approved the retention incentive at its June meeting. With the university facing system-wide budget cuts and declining state funding, President Gamble says the timing was bad.
It just is not a good time to be personally standing up and smiling because you get a big bonus when you've got a tight budget and you're looking at dropping programs or dropping people.
Ultimately, Gamble says the sentiment of the students, staff, and faculty played a significant role in his decision to ask the board to reconsider the bonus.
My ability to actually deal with the people that I have to deal with to move this university forward, that's where my concern lied. And that's where I was beginning to have feelings that I was starting to lose some of that, and that's why I made the recommendation to the board.
The bonus would have been awarded at the end of President Gamble's current contract in May 2016. UA retention bonuses are not without precedent. The Board of Regents awarded previous UA President Mark Hamilton $70,000 for each year of his three-year contract as a retention bonus. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Pacific walrus populations in Alaska's Bering Strait and Chukchi Sea area declined by half between 1981 and 1999. New research indicates the decline may have slowed down in the years before 2000. According to Rebecca Taylor, a research statistician with the U.S. Geological Survey, researchers relied on data about the demographic composition of the walrus population from 1976 to 2000 to make that determination.
While our study encompassed data that went from 1975 through 2006, those age composition data went from, there was a period in the early 80s starting with 1981, and then there was another period in the late 90s. And so it's that 81 to 99 time period where we have the most informative data and therefore are most confident about the population trend.
Taylor says further study is necessary to determine the most recent status of the walrus population. She says researchers used only data for female walrus.
Because walruses are polygamous, so you don't need that many males to get the job done. So it's typical with a polygamous species to track females only. And so we did that in this analysis.
She says the information USGS has indicates that in the 1980s, the female walrus population was aging, making up about 85% of the adults, thus producing fewer juveniles.
So that suggests that reproduction and calf survival were probably quite low at that point. So that is what we believe initiated the population decline.
A decade later, The walrus population began to get younger, so the decline lessened as the younger walrus population grew. Taylor says her study only looked at demographic and population growth rates to quantify trends, not to find a cause. But she says other research indicates hunting is likely to have had a bearing on the decline.
It was thought that the walrus population probably was depressed by hunting in the 1950s. And that regulations put in place in the 1960s probably allowed that population to increase quite a bit. And so by sometime between the mid-70s to the early 80s, it's thought that the walrus population was probably quite high compared to what the environment could support, and that probably initiated the decline.
She says changes in sea ice conditions could also affect Pacific walrus populations. Taylor's research is being done to help the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service make a determination to list the Pacific walrus as threatened by 2017. Andrea Medeiros with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says a lawsuit filed by the Center for Biological Diversity has prompted the research in response to a court order. The state of Alaska is proposing several changes in how they deliver voting information to Alaska Natives whose first language is Yupik or Gwich'in. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more on the state's plan.
The state is offering the changes after a federal judge issued a decision in a voting rights lawsuit last week. U.S. District Judge Sharon Gleason ordered the state to better help voters who speak Yupik and Gwich'in understand their ballots. Elizabeth Bacalar is the lead attorney for the state on the case. She says that the state is focused on three areas.
That voters need better information ahead of the election, that language assistance is available, that outreach workers need to be better prepared to provide language assistance to voters, especially prior to Election Day, and to better address certain dialectical differences. So those are the three areas in which the interim remedies we're proposing are meant to target, and certainly any long-term remedies would probably target those areas as well.
Bacalar explains the state is preparing different versions of ballot language to send to tribal councils and outreach workers to reflect different dialects. She says they're looking for feedback from speakers.
Send copies of the Central Yupik ballot to the tribal councils from the Bethel census area to the Dillingham and Wade-Hampton census areas, and prepare different versions of ballot measure language to send to tribal councils and outreach workers and get input from the plaintiffs on potential dialect differences in the ballot measures.
Oscar Alexi teaches Central Yupik at the UAF Kuskokwim campus in Bethel. He's also worked on Yupik translations of ballot materials for the state. He says that most bureaucratic language used to explain ballot measures and other choices on ballots simply does not exist in Yupik. In addition, there are several regional dialects of Yupik which lack the specificity needed, making ballot translation next to impossible. Alexi says the best situation would be to have translators from each community reading the ballot to Yupik-speaking voters, because Yupik was only recently codified in the last generation or so. So most people will understand best if they hear the translations rather than read them.
We translated the material where it could be read to voters, and hopefully, you know, we'd have people at the polling places that can read, you know, in an understandable voice, not make it sound like they're reading, but talking to someone, you know, in the Yupik language, where they'd follow along and understand it.
The state already provides that service and will be doing more to promote its availability under the plan. It's a big undertaking to provide language assistance and translations in numerous dialects, but the court is clear that the state has an obligation to do so. Alexi says he worries about the possible negative impacts of the lawsuit on language translation in the state. He makes his point by comparing the dedicated and hardworking translators to a dog team. He says you can expect a lot from a dog. They're hard workers and they like to pull, but they can only do so much, especially in the short period of time leading up to the November election.
Growing up, I remember my brother-in-law saying, "Nuff doot, they break." A dog, if you ran it beyond its limitations, where you expected it to pull and pull and pull, and not giving it some rest in between, there'll be a point where the dog breaks and will never pull again.
The plaintiffs, Alaska Native speakers from southwestern and interior Alaska, being represented by attorneys from the Native American Rights Fund, have until Wednesday to respond to the plan. Then Judge Gleason will issue an order telling the state what they need to do. Judge Gleason has not yet ruled on whether the state intentionally violated voters' rights on the basis of race or color. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Coming up, discussing the dangers of alcohol during pregnancy.
The Kenai School District, along with Anchorage School District, are the first school districts in North America to attempt to deal with the challenges faced by students with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
A long standoff between police and an armed man in Fairbanks ended with the suspect being taken into custody alive this afternoon. 38-year-old Michael Bracht was arrested outside a West Fairbanks convenience store around 1:15 following more than 9 hours of negotiations by police to get him to surrender. Bracht had escaped from the North Star halfway house in Esther. He has a long rap sheet and most recent offenses being theft and parole violation. Fairbanks Police Tactical Team Commander Lieutenant Eric Jukes says officers initially tried to arrest Bracht around 2 a.m. Tuesday while he was parked in an SUV outside a local supermarket.
Involved a vehicle pursuit where he rammed at least 2, if not 3, patrol cars and then attempted to ram several civilian vehicles. It ended up here in the Justice Store parking lot where his vehicle was disabled from spike strips that we laid down during the pursuit.
Lieutenant Jukes says Bracht's fiance was in the SUV but got out safely at the store. Bracht refused to leave the car, brandishing a pistol and threatening to kill himself.
We spent a lot of time with him just asking us to kill him. He wanted us to shoot him. That was part of his goal for an extended period of time. And so I think maybe we finally convinced him that that's not where we wanted to go and he wasn't going to get us there.
Jukes says Bracht eventually exited the vehicle and put the gun down. Charges are expected to be filed against him. Lieutenant Jukes says the successful resolution of the standoff is justification for well-equipped and trained law enforcement.
There's been a lot of controversy about the militarization of police and armored vehicles. That kept us safe. That kept us up close and personal to be able to talk to him and not hurt him. That's our goal. We have all this stuff. So we don't have to hurt people.
The standoff shut down roads in an area of West Fairbanks, slowing the morning commute, delaying school buses, and forcing lockdowns at area schools. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports some Fairbanks schools have been on high security alert in the last 2 days due to 2 separate incidences.
Karen Gaborik is the school district interim superintendent. She says at least 140 kids were late to morning classes.
You know, that's a fair number of students coming late to school. So we also had staff who got stuck in traffic as well.
Gaborik says other staff were assigned to cover classes for teachers who weren't able to arrive on time. She also placed 2 elementary schools in close proximity to the standoff in secured building mode.
So basically that means the exterior doors of the building are locked. We won't have any outside activities, no outside recess. So it's a monitored access to the building.
It was the second time in as many days that Gaborik had to partially close down activity at schools in the district. On Monday, a threatening message sent through Twitter raised concerns among administrators and law enforcement.
A community member actually let the principal of West Valley High School, Dave Foshi, know that there had been a vague sort of threat posted on Twitter. So he called the Alaska State Troopers. Because there was a threat, West Valley went into sit-tight mode, which is a little bit more secure situation. You don't have as much movement inside the building, and so kids stay in classes.
Ultimately, 5 schools were placed in sit-tight mode. Gaborik, who attended both elementary and high school in Fairbanks, acknowledges that situations like those over the last few days have become more common in recent years, But she says personnel regularly practice procedures to handle them.
I think it gives us actually the opportunity to have a predictable response to situations. You know, we can use the phrase with principals, I need you to secure the building, and principals know what that means, and staff know what that means. And we continually work to educate parents and students around what those things mean.
Classes and after-school activities at schools affected by both incidents have since returned to a normal schedule. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Today is National FASD Awareness Day. FASD, or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, is a developmental disability caused by prenatal exposure to alcohol. Alaska and some of its schools are at the forefront of working to understand and prevent it. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder occurs everywhere people drink. That's according to Deb Evenson, a consultant who works with behaviorally challenged kids across the country.
Alaska has a high rate of children, adolescents, and adults with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and guess what? So does the rest of the country. What's exciting is that in Alaska, we're talking about it.
That's the approach two school districts in Alaska are taking to deal with FASD. Conversation.
The Kenai School District, along with Anchorage School District, are the first school districts in North America to attempt to deal with the challenges faced by students with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders in every grade level and every program. That's gigantic.
Evenson says it's a ground-up approach. The schools are working with outside consultants like her to educate teachers about handling kids with FASD in the classroom. They've been provided informational materials and workshops and been given access to college-level courses on the topic.
We believe that the challenges in a system are best solved by the people that are on the grassroots level, and that the school teachers in this district and administrators in this district are the best problem solvers.
By ensuring educators understand FASD, Evenson says it gives them the tools to create a structured, clear, and appropriate learning environment for all of their students. She says between 2 and 7% of all students in the U.S. are prenatally exposed to alcohol. That's why she says the education has to start at home.
A diagnosis of an FASD is the key to unlock the door to know how to work with a child.
The most important resource that we have is knowledge.
Vicki Tinker is the coordinator of the FASD program at Frontier Community Services in Kenai. She says education over the last decade means a lot of women know that no amount of alcohol is safe while pregnant. But the numbers haven't changed much. So she says there has to be communication across the board to deal with the whole issue.
You know, if we can help this generation to understand the damage that drinking during pregnancy does, and if we can help the people who already have FASD as they are planning their families and growing into adulthood, I think we do a lot to prevent the next generation. And if our legal professionals understand it, if our medical professionals understand it, and if our teachers and all those people have influence, I think that's the most powerful thing we can do.
That means talking about contributing factors like access to birth control, familial alcoholism, and more. She says there's often a correlation between historical trauma and abuse in the mother's life that can lead to drinking while pregnant.
There's a huge overlap between trauma and FASD. So pretty much everybody who walks in our door with FASD also is dealing with trauma. It's just the nature of their lives and what they're born into, and we address both issues. And so we're really at the forefront of what's happening in the field of FASD and in the field of trauma.
It's a societal issue that communities need to be open about. Deb Evenson says addressing it takes courage. But because Alaska and its schools are taking a holistic approach, talking about all of the issues, social, cultural, and medical, she thinks there's hope for the future.
We'll look back in our history books or read in our however we learn then about a challenging time in our culture. And there was a lot of trauma. A lot of women drank during pregnancy, and we didn't know what it did. And a lot of children were born with FASD. But that doesn't exist anymore. So that's where we're going.
And it all starts with education. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
The city of Unalaska is falling behind on construction of a new wastewater treatment plant, and they could face up to a $200,000 fine in in federal fines as a result. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
The city's supposed to have the plant's chlorination and dechlorination system online by the end of the year. And in mid-November, they're supposed to make a formal request to Alaska regulators to start operating that system. But the city isn't going to make those deadlines. The contractor that's working on the plant is blaming delays on shoddy preparatory work done at the site last year by Advanced Blasting, a Wasilla-based company. Issues with the blasting work pushed the wastewater plant construction schedule forward. Now, an Alaska City Manager Chris Laddick says they could miss the deadline to get permission to run the chlorine system by more than 100 days.
And we'll have to, at that point, pay some fines.
The Environmental Protection Agency has the option to charge the city for every day they're late. It's part of a settlement reached in 2012 after the EPA sued Unalaska for improper wastewater discharge. As part of that settlement, the city agreed to build a new wastewater plant in line with national standards. Laddick says the chlorine system's an important part of the upgrade.
So the chlorine kills the E. coli. You take the chlorine out and it goes out in the ocean.
Now that system probably won't be ready until the spring, but Laddick's hoping the city can avoid the fines if they get back on track to meet their final deadline. They're supposed to get the whole plant up and running by the end of 2015. If the EPA decides to impose the fines, Laddick says the city may seek payment from Advanced Blasting to cover the costs. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
16 handheld thermal imaging cameras will soon be in the hands of search and rescue teams in the Norton Sound region, thanks to a donation from Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation. Alaska State Troopers will be distributing these biocular cameras to 15 NSEDC member communities and Shishmaref within the next few weeks. Dan Harrelson, Village Public Safety Officer for White Mountain and Chairman of NSEDC's Board of Directors, says previously only one thermal imaging camera based out of Nome was shared among all 16 communities.
When you need a piece of equipment, you need it right now. And usually when we have searches, it's inclement weather, stormy weather, where we're probably not able to get airplanes. And so to have to wait for a unit to come from Nome, you know, it could be 8 hours, it could be 3 days before you could get the unit. You know, time is of the essence. It's critical when you're doing searches for people.
Harrelson says if the camera did arrive with enough time to be used in a search, VPSOs had to learn to operate the new piece of equipment in the middle of a rescue. Now, with a camera in each village, he's hopeful search and rescue teams will be able to practice using them. Harrelson hasn't used one of the cameras yet, but says they'll work sort of like night vision goggles.
Any source that gives off any heat will show up as a greenish-yellow spot on the thermal imaging unit. And the closer you are to the unit, up to about 400 yards, I believe, you can actually make out the figure of a person if they're standing there or laying in the snow.
The cameras are water-resistant and can operate down to negative 40 degrees, which is necessary since many search and rescue operations are conducted in extreme weather conditions.
Our searches seem like they come in the most miserable times of the year, where visibility is very limited. You know, when people are traveling from one village to the other, or they go out hunting and they fail to make their destination or fail to come back home on time. So a lot of our searches are in the wintertime.
Harrelson anticipates the cameras will make an appearance during annual VPSO training this year in Anchorage in November. Harrelson says the cameras should arrive in villages within the next couple of weeks. Terms like tribal sovereignty, native rights, and co-management are all open to interpretation. One of the most vocal groups in the YK Delta, Upete Nation, recently met to hash out their vision of future governance in the region. As KYUK's Ben Matheson reports, members have a spectrum of views about what tribal sovereignty really means.
A few dozen people gathered in the Akyechuk School Gym last month for 2 days of Upete Nation discussions at their annual meeting. A similar set of topics comes up at every meeting: subsistence, co-management, the most basic idea of governance, and what role local tribes, who are members of Upete Nation, want to play. Ivan M. Ivan is the tribal council president in Akiak.
We're not trying to become a government that runs villages. The villages have their power by themselves to control their own destiny. But collectively, together, I believe they can help each other.
There is, however, long-standing discussion about forming a regional tribal government. UP Nation Chief Mike Williams said after the meeting that that vision includes a legislative, executive, and judicial branch. He says the current governmental structure holds tribes back.
Because there's 56 individual federally recognized tribes in our area, and the respect is there. If 56 tribes unite together, I think we can begin to deal with these issues that are not good for us and helping managing our way of life like we have been doing that for thousands of years.
Williams calls Upete Nation a consortium of federally recognized tribes formed in 1978 with 19 tribes. Williams says there are now 12 tribes with active members. The core of the group, however, is centered in Akiak, Akichuk, Tuluksak, and Kwethluk. Critics say the outspoken group doesn't represent the majority of YK Delta tribal members. Still, the group pushes for a shift of the power to tribes in rural Alaska. Philip Peter Sr. is the Akichuk Native Community President. He says his ancestors controlled their own destiny, and today there are too many laws and regulations. Still, he wants tribes to be partners with existing governments.
The vision is to help ourselves in working with our federal and state governments. We're not trying to take away the power from the government and state. All we want to do is work with them.
Moses Owen from Akiak takes a harder line for Upete Nation.
You know, it's getting tougher for us to survive with the laws, regulations. We just got to get back to where we were before, you know. No laws, no rules, nothing, just our way of life. We want to practice that.
Chief Mike Williams says the group held off on elections, which were scheduled for their meeting on August 22nd and 23rd. He says they'll likely take place at an upcoming meeting. And Upete Nation isn't the only group talking about building new tribal government structures. For example, the YK Delta Regional Committee, which is a group facilitated by Chilista, the regional native corporation, is also drafting a constitution for a possible future tribal government. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Jen Ruckel in Nome, and Dacia Eaton and Ben Matheson in Bethel. APRN's Josh Edge reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere and Bobcat, celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.